37. 4:30 in the morning. Webster was more than ready for the watch change. Johnson and Garber and the general's aide were dozing in their chairs. McGrath was outside with the telephone lineman. They were just finishing up. The job had taken much longer than they had anticipated. Some kind of interface problem. They had physically cut the phone line coming out of York and bent the stiff copper down to a temporary terminal box they had placed at the base of a pole. Then they had spooled cable from the terminal box down the road to the mobile command vehicle, connected it into one of the communications ports. But it didn't work. Not right away. The lineman had fussed with multimeters and muttered about impedances and capacitances. They had worked for 3 solid hours. They were ready to blame the army truck for the incompatibility when they thought to go back and check their own temporary terminal box. The fault lay there, a failed component. They wired in a spare, and the whole circuit worked perfectly. 4:35 in the morning, McGrath was shaking their hands and swearing them to silence when Webster came out of the trailer. The two men stood and watched them drive away. The noise of their truck died around the curve. Webster and McGrath stayed standing in the bright moonlight. They stood there for 5 minutes while McGrath smoked. They didn't speak, just gazed north into the distance and wondered. "Go wake your boys up," Webster said. "We'll stand down for a spell." McGrath nodded and walked down to the accommodation trailers, roused Milosevic and Brogan. They were fully dressed on their bunks. They got up and yawned, came down the ladder, and found Webster standing there with Johnson and his aide, Garber standing behind them. "The telephone line is done," Webster said.
"Already?" Brogan said. I thought it was being done in the morning."
"We figured sooner was better than later," Webster said. He inclined his head toward General Johnson. It was a gesture which said, "He's worried, right?"
"Okay," Milosevic said. "We'll look after it."
"Wake us at 8, Webster said. "Or earlier, if necessary, okay?" Brogan nodded and walked north to the command vehicle. Milosevic followed. They paused together for a look at the mountains in the moonlight. As they paused, the fax machine inside the empty command trailer started whirring. It fed its first communication face upward into the message tray. It was 10 to 5 in the morning, Friday, the 4th of July. Brogan woke General Johnson 1 hour and 10 minutes later, 6 o'clock exactly. He knocked loudly on the accommodation trailer door and got no response, so he went in and shook the old guy by the shoulder.
"Peterson Air Force Base, sir," Brogan said. "They need to talk to you."
Johnson staggered up to the command vehicle in his shirt and pants. Milosevic joined Brogan outside in the pre-dawn glow to give him some privacy. Johnson was back out in 5 minutes. "We need a conference," he called. He ducked back into the trailer. Milosevic walked down and roused the others. They came forward, Webster and the general's aide yawning and stretching, Garber, ramrod straight. McGrath was dressed and smoking. Maybe hadn't tried to sleep at all. They filed up the ladder and took their places around the table, bleak red eyes, hair fuzzed on the back from the pillows. "Peterson called," Johnson told them. "They're sending a helicopter search and rescue out, first light, looking for the missile unit." His aide nodded.
"That would be standard procedure," he said.
"Based on an assumption," Johnson said. "They think the unit has suffered some kind of mechanical and electrical malfunction."
"Which is not uncommon," his aide said. "If their radio fails, their procedure would be to repair it. If a truck also broke down at the same time, their procedure would be to wait as a group for assistance."
"Circle the wagons," McGrath said.
The aide nodded again.
"Exactly so," he said. "They would pull off the road and wait for a chopper."
"So, do we tell them?"
McGrath asked. The aide sat forward.
"That's the question," he said. "Tell them what, exactly? We don't even know for sure that these maniacs have got them at all. It's still possible it's just a radio problem and a truck problem together."
"Dream on," Johnson said. Webster shrugged. He knew how to deal with such issues.
What's the upside? He said.
There is no upside, Johnson said. We tell Peterson the missiles have been captured, the cat's out of the bag. We lose control of the situation. We're seen to have disobeyed Washington by making an issue out of it before Monday.
Okay, so what's the downside? Webster asked.
Theoretical, Johnson said. We have to assume they've been captured, so we also have to assume they've been well hidden, in which case the Air Force will never find them. They'll just fly around for a while and then go home and wait.
Webster nodded. Okay, he said. No upside, no downside, no problem.
There was a short silence. So we sit tight, Johnson said. We let the chopper fly. McGrath shook his head, incredulous.
Suppose they use them to shoot the chopper down, he asked.
The general's aide smiled an indulgent smile. Can't be done, he said. The IFF wouldn't allow it.
IFF? McGrath repeated.
Identify friend or foe, the aide said. It's an electronic system. The chopper will be beaming a signal. The missile reads it as friendly, refuses to launch.
Guaranteed?
McGrath asked. The aide nodded. Foolproof, he said. Garber glowered at him, but he said nothing. Not his field of expertise.
Okay, Webster said. Back to bed. Wake us again at 8, Brogan.
On the tarmac at Peterson, a Boeing CH-47D Chinook was warming its engines and sipping the first of its 858 gallons of fuel. A Chinook is a giant aircraft whose twin rotors thump through an oval of air 100 feet long and 60 wide. It weighs more than 10 tons empty, and it can lift another 11. It's a giant flying box, the engines and the fuel tanks strapped to the top and the sides, the crew perched high at the front. Any helicopter can search, but when heavy equipment is at stake, only a Chinook can rescue. Because of the holiday weekend, the Peterson dispatcher assigned a skeleton crew of two, no separate spotter. He figured he didn't need one. How difficult could it be to find five Army trucks on some shoulder in Montana?
You should have stayed here, Borkin said. Right, Joe?
Reacher glanced into the gloom inside the punishment hut. Joseph Ray was standing to attention on the yellow square. He was staring straight ahead. He was naked, bleeding from the mouth and nose.
Right, Joe?
Borkin said again. Ray made no reply. Borkin walked over and crashed his fist into his face. Ray stumbled and fell backward, staggered against the back wall, and scrambled to regain his position on the square.
I asked you a question, Borkin said.
Ray nodded. The blood poured off his chin.
Creatures should have stayed near, he said.
Borkin hit him again, a hard, straight right to the face. Ray's head snapped back. Blood spurted. Borkin smiled.
No talking when you're on the square, Joe, he said. You know the rules.
Borkin stepped back and placed the muzzle of the Sig Sauer in Reacher's ear, used it to propel him out into the clearing, gestured Stevie to follow.
You stay on the square, Joe, he called over his shoulder.
Stevie slammed the door shut. Borkin reversed his direction and used the Sig Sauer to shove Reacher toward him.
Tell Fowler to get rid of this guy, he told him. He's outlived his usefulness, such as it ever was. Put the bitch back in her room. Put a ring of sentries right around the building. We got things to do, right? No time for this shit. Parade ground at 6:30, everybody there. I'm going to read them the proclamation before we fax it.
McGrath couldn't sleep. He walked back to the accommodations trailer with the others and got back on his bunk, but he gave it up after 10 minutes. 7:15 in the morning, he was back in the command vehicle with Brogan and Milosevic.
You guys take a break if you want, he said. I'll look after things here.
We could go organize some breakfast, Brogan said. Dinah's and Kalispell should be open by now.
McGrath nodded vaguely,
started into his jacket for his wallet.
Don't worry about it,
Brogan said.
I'll pay. My treat.
Okay, thanks, McGrath said. Get coffee. Lots of it.
Brogan and Milosevic stood up and left. McGrath stood in the doorway and watched them drive an army sedan south. The sound of the car faded, and he was left with the silent humming of the equipment behind him. He turned to sit down. The clock ticked around to 7. The fax machine started whirring. Holly smoothed her hands over the old mattress like Reacher was there on it, like it was really his body under her, scarred and battered, hot and hard and muscular, not a worn, striped cotton cover stuffed with ancient horsehair. She blinked the tears out of her eyes, blew a deep sigh, and focused on the next decision. No Reacher, no Jackson, no weapon, no tools, 6 sentries in the street outside. She glanced around the room for the 1,000th time and started scoping it out all over again. McGrath woke the others by thumping on the sides of the accommodations trailer with both fists. Then he ran back to the command post and found a 3rd copy of the message spooling out of the machine. He already had 2. Now he had 3. Webster was the first into the trailer, then Johnson, a minute behind, then Garber, and finally the general's aide. They rattled up the ladder one by one and hurried over to the table. McGrath was absorbed in reading.
What, Mac? Webster asked him. They're declaring independence, McGrath said. Listen to this.
He glanced around the 4 faces, started reading out loud.
Governments are instituted among men, he read, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. It is the right of the people to alter or abolish them after a long train of abuses and usurpations.
They're quoting from the original, Webster said.
Paraphrasing, Garber said.
McGrath nodded.
Listen to this, he said again. The history of the present government of the United States is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all designed to establish an absolute tyranny over the people.
What the hell is this? Webster said. 1776 all over again?
It gets worse, McGrath said. We, therefore, are the representatives of the free states of America, located initially in what was formerly York County in what was formerly Montana, and we solemnly publish and declare that this territory is now a free and independent state, which is absolved of allegiance to the United States, with all political connection totally dissolved, and that as a free and independent state has full power to levy war, conclude peace, defend its land borders and its airspace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other things as all independent states may do.
He looked up, shuffled the 3 copies into a neat stack, and laid them on the table in silence.
Why 3 copies? Garber asked.
3 destinations, McGrath said. If we hadn't intercepted them, they'd be all over the place by now.
Where? Webster asked.
First one is a D.C. number, McGrath said. I'm guessing it's the White House.
Johnson's aide scooted his chair to the computer terminal. McGrath read him the number. He tapped it in and the screen scrolled down. He nodded. The White House, he said. Next?
New York, somewhere, McGrath said.
Read out the number from the 2nd sheet. United Nations, the aide said. They want witnesses.
3rd one, I don't know, McGrath said. Area code is 404.
Atlanta, Georgia, Garber said.
What's in Atlanta, Georgia? Webster asked.
The aide was busy at the keyboard.
CNN, he said. They want publicity.
Johnson nodded.
Smart moves, he said. They want it all on live TV. Christ, can you imagine? The United Nations as umpires and round-the-clock coverage on the cable news, the whole world watching?
So what do we do? Webster asked. There was a long silence.
Why did they say airspace? Garber asked out loud.
They were paraphrasing, Webster said. 1776, there wasn't any airspace.
The missiles, Garber said. Is it possible they've disabled the IFF?
There was another long silence. They heard a car pull up. Doors slammed. Brogan and Milosevic rattled up the ladder and stepped into the hush. They carried brown bags and styrofoam cups with plastic lids. The giant search-and-rescue Chinook made it north from Peterson in Colorado to Malmstrom Air Force Base outside of Great Falls in Montana without incident. It touched down there, and fuel bowsers came out to meet it. The crew walked to the mess for coffee. Walked back 20 minutes later. Took off again and swung gently in the morning air before lumbering away northwest.
38.
We're getting no reaction, Fowler said.
Makes us wonder why.
Reacher shrugged at him. They were in the command hut. Stevie had dragged him through the trees to the bastion, and then Fowler had dragged him back again with two armed guards. The punishment hut was unavailable, still occupied by Joseph Ray. They used the command hut instead. They sat Reacher down, and Fowler locked his left wrist to the arm of the chair with a handcuff. The guards took up position on either side, rifles sloped, watchful. Then Fowler walked up to join Borkin and Stevie for the ceremony on the parade ground. Reacher heard faint shouting and cheering in the distance as the proclamation was read out. Then he heard nothing. 90 minutes later, Fowler came back to the hut alone. He sat down behind Borkin's desk and lit a cigarette, and the armed guards remained standing.
"We faxed it an hour ago," Fowler said. "No reaction."
Reacher smelled his smoke and gazed at the banners on the walls. Dark reds and dull whites, vivid, crooked symbols in black.
"Do you know why we're getting no reaction?" Fowler asked.
Reacher just shook his head.
"You know what I think?" Fowler said. "They cut the line. Phone company is colluding with the federal agents. We were told it would happen at 7:30. It obviously happened earlier."
Reacher shrugged again, made no reply.
"We would expect to be informed about a thing like that," Fowler said.
He picked up his Glock and propped it in front of him, butt on the desktop, swiveling it like naval artillery left and right.
"And we haven't been," he said.
"Maybe your pal from Chicago has given you up," Reacher said.
Fowler shook his head. His Glock came to rest, aimed at Reacher's chest.
"We've been getting a stream of intelligence," he said. "We know where they are, how many of them there are, what their intentions are. But now, when we still need information, we aren't getting it. Communication has been interrupted."
Reacher said nothing.
"We're investigating," Fowler said. "We're checking the radio right now."
Reacher said nothing.
"Anything you want to tell us about the radio?" Fowler asked.
"What radio?" Reacher said.
"It worked okay yesterday," Fowler said. "Now it doesn't work at all. And you were wandering around all night."
He ducked down and rolled open the drawer where Borkin kept the Colt Marshall. But he didn't come out with a revolver. He came out with a small, black radio transmitter.
"This was Jackson's," he said. "He was most anxious to show us where it was hidden. In fact, he was begging to show us. He screamed and cried and begged. Just about tore his fingernails off digging it up, he was so anxious."
He smiled and put the unit carefully in his pocket.
"We figure we just switch it on," he said. "That should put us straight through to the federal scum, person to person. This stage of the process, we need to talk direct, see if we can persuade them to restore our fax line."
"Terrific plan," Reacher said.
"The fax line is important, you see," Fowler said. "Vital. The world must be allowed to know what we're doing here. The world must be allowed to watch and witness. History is being made here. You understand that, right?"
Reacher stared at the wall.
"They've got cameras, you know," Fowler said. "Surveillance planes are up there right now. Now it's daylight again, they can see what we're doing. So how can we exploit that fact?"
Reacher shook his head.
"You can leave me out of it," he said.
Fowler smiled. Of course we'll leave you out of it, he said. Why would they care about seeing you nailed to a tree? You're nothing but a piece of shit to us and to them. But Holly Johnson, there's a different story. Maybe we'll call them up on their own little transmitter and tell them to watch us do it with their own spy cameras. That might make them think about it. They might trade a fax line for her left breast. He ground out his cigarette, leaned forward, spoke quietly. We're serious here, Reacher, he said. You saw what we did to Jackson. We could do that to her. We could do that to you. We need to be able to communicate with the world. We need that fax line. So we need the shortwave to confirm what the hell they've done with it. We need those things very badly. You understand that, right? So, if you want to avoid a lot of unnecessary pain for you and for her, you better tell me what you did to the radio. Reacher was twisted around, looking at the bookcase, trying to recall the details of the inexpert translations of the Japanese Pearl Harbor texts he'd read. Tell me now, Fowler said softly. I can keep them away from you and from her. No pain for either of you. Otherwise, nothing I can do about it. He laid his Glock on the desk. You want a cigarette? He asked. He held out the pack, smiled. The good cop, the friend, the ally, the protector, the oldest routine in the book, requiring the oldest response. Reacher glanced around. Two guards, one on each side of him, the right-hand guard nearer, the left-hand guard back almost against the side wall, rifles held easy in the crook of their arms. Fowler behind the desk holding out the pack. Reacher shrugged and nodded, took a cigarette with his free right hand. He hadn't smoked in 10 years, but when somebody offers you a lethal weapon, you take it. So tell me, Fowler said, and be quick. He thumbed his lighter and held it out. Reacher bent forward and lit his cigarette from the flame, took a deep draw and leaned back. The smoke felt good. 10 years and he still enjoyed it. He inhaled deeply and took another lungful. How did you disable our radio? Fowler asked. Reacher took a third pull, trickled the smoke out of his nose and held the cigarette like a sentry does, between the thumb and forefinger, palm hooded around it. Take quick, deep pulls, and the coal on the end of a cigarette heats up to a couple of thousand degrees, lengthens to a point. He rotated his palm like he was studying the glowing tip while he thought about something, until the cigarette was pointing straight forward like an arrow. How did you disable our radio? Fowler asked again. You'll hurt Holly if I don't tell you? Reacher asked back. Fowler nodded, smiled his lipless smile. That's a promise, he said. I'll hurt her so bad, she'll be begging to die. Reacher shrugged unhappily, sketched a listen-up gesture. Fowler nodded and shuffled on his chair and leaned close. Reacher snapped forward and jammed the cigarette into his eye. Fowler screamed, and Reacher was on his feet, the chair cuffed to his wrist, clattering after him. He windmilled right, and the chair swung through a wide arc and smashed against the nearer guard's head. It splintered and jerked away as Reacher danced to his left. He caught the farther guard with a forearm smash to the throat as his rifle came up, snapped back, and hit Fowler with the wreckage of the chair, used the follow-through momentum to swing back to the first guard, finished him with an elbow to the head. The guy went down. Reacher grabbed his rifle by the barrel and swung straight back at the other guard, felt skull bones explode under the butt. He dropped the rifle and spun and smashed the chair to pieces against Fowler's shoulders, grabbed him by the ears and smashed his face into the desktop, once, twice, three times. Took a leg from the broken chair and jammed it crossways under his throat, folded his elbows around each exposed end and locked his hands together, tested his grip and bunched his shoulders, jerked hard once, and broke Fowler's neck against the chair leg with a single loud crunch. He took both rifles and the Glock and the handcuff key, out the door and around to the back of the hut, straight into the trees. He put the Glock in his pocket, took the handcuff off his wrist, put a rifle in each hand, breathing hard. He was in pain. Swinging the heavy wooden chair had opened the red weal on his wrist into a wound. He raised it to his mouth and sucked at it and buttoned the cuff of his shirt over it. Then he heard a helicopter, the faint bass thumping of a heavy twin-rotor machine, a Boeing, a C-9 or a Chinook, far to the southeast. He thought, last night Borkin talked about 8 Marines. They've only got 8 Marines, he said. The Marines use C-9s. He thought, they're going for a frontal assault. Holly's paneled walls flashed into his mind, and he set off racing through the trees. He got as far as the bastion. The thumping from the air built louder. He risked stepping out onto the stony path. It was a Chinook, not a Sea Knight. Search and rescue markings, not Marine Corps. It was following the road up from the southeast, a mile away, 100 feet up, using its vicious downdraft to part the surrounding foliage and aid its search. It looked slow and ponderous, hanging nose down in the air, yawing slightly from side to side as it approached. Reacher guessed it must be pretty close to the town of York itself. Then he glanced into the clearing and saw a guy, 50 yards away, a grunt, camouflage fatigues, a stinger on his shoulder, turning and aiming through the crude open sight. He saw him acquire the target. The guy steadied himself and stood with his feet apart. His hand fumbled for the activator. The missile's infrared sensor turned on. Reacher waited for the IFF to shut it down. It didn't happen. The missile started squealing its high-pitched tone. It was locked on to the heat from the Chinook's engines. The guy's finger tightened on the trigger. Reacher dropped the rifle in his left hand, swung the other one up, and clicked the safety off with his thumb as he did so, stepped to his left and leaned his shoulder on a tree, aimed at the guy's head, and fired. But the guy fired first. A fraction of a second before Reacher's bullet killed him, he pulled the Stinger's trigger. Two things happened. The Stinger's rocket motor lit up. It exploded along its launch tube. Then the guy was hit in the head. The impact knocked him sideways. The launcher caught the rear of the missile and flipped it. It came out and stalled tail down in the air like a javelin, cushioned on the thrust of its launch, virtually motionless. Then it corrected itself. Reacher watched in horror as it did exactly what it was designed to do. Its 8 little wings popped out. It hung almost vertical until it acquired the helicopter again. Then its second stage rocket lit up and it blasted into the sky. Before the guy's body hit the ground, it was homing in on the Chinook at 1,000 miles an hour. The Chinook was lumbering steadily northwest, a mile away, following the road. The road ran straight up through the town, between the abandoned buildings. On the southeast corner, the first building it passed was the courthouse. The Chinook was closing on it at 80 miles an hour. The Stinger was heading in to meet it at 1,000 miles an hour. 1 mile at 1,000 miles an hour. 1/1000th of an hour. A fraction over 3.5 seconds. It felt like a lifetime to Reacher. He watched the missile all the way. A wonderful, brutal weapon. A simple, unshakable purpose. Designed to recognize the exact heat signature of aircraft exhaust. Designed to follow it until it either got there or ran out of fuel. A simple 3.5-second mission. The Chinook pilot saw it early. He wasted the first second of its flight frozen. Not in horror, not in fear, just in simple disbelief that a heat-seeking missile had been fired at him from a small wooded clearing in Montana. Then his instinct and training took over. Evade and avoid. Evade the missile, avoid crashing on settlements below. Reacher saw him throw the nose down and the tail up. The big Chinook wheeled away and spewed a wide fan of exhaust into the atmosphere. Then the tail flipped the other way, engines screaming, superheated fumes spraying another random arc. The missile patiently followed the first curve, tightened its radius. The Chinook dropped slowly and then rose violently in the air, spiraled upward and away from the town. The missile turned and followed the second arc, arrived at where the heat had been a split second before, couldn't find it. It turned a full, lazy circle right underneath the helicopter, caught an echo of a new maneuver and set about climbing a relentless new spiral. The pilot won an extra second, but that was all. The stinger caught him right at the top of his desperate climb. It followed the trail of heat all the way into the starboard engine itself, exploded hard against the exhaust nacelle. 6.5 pounds of high explosive against 10 tons of aircraft, but the explosive always wins. Reacher saw the starboard engine disintegrate, then the rear rotor housing blow off. Shattered fragments of the drivetrain exploded outward like shrapnel, and the rotor detached and spun away in terrible slow motion. The Chinook stalled in the air and fell, tail down, checked only by the screaming forward rotor, and slowly spun to the earth like a whole ship slips slowly below the sea. Holly heard the helicopter. She heard the low-frequency beat pulsing faintly through her walls. She heard it grow louder. Then she heard the explosion and the shriek of the forward rotor grabbing the air. Then she heard nothing. She jammed her elbow into her crutch and limped across to the diagonal partition. The prison room was completely empty except for the mattress, so her search was going to have to start again in the bathroom.
"Only one question," Webster said. "How long can we keep the lid on this?"
General Johnson said nothing in reply. Neither did his aide. Webster moved his gaze across to Garber. Garber was looking grim.
"Not too damn long," he said.
"But how long?" Webster asked. "A day? An hour?"
6 hours, Garber said.
"Why?"
McGrath asked.
"Standard procedure," Garber said. "They'll investigate the crash, obviously. Normally they'd send another chopper out, but not if there's a suspicion of ground fire, so they'll come by road from Malmstrom. 6 hours.
Webster nodded, turned to Johnson.
"Can you delay them, General?" he asked.
Johnson shook his head.
"Not really," he said. His voice was low and resigned.
"They just lost a Chinook, crew of 2. I can't call them and say, 'Do me a favor, don't investigate that.' I could try, I guess, and they might agree at first, but it would leak, and then we'd be back where we started. Might gain us an hour."
Webster nodded. 7 hours? 6 hours? What's the difference?" he said.
Nobody replied.
"We've got to move now," McGrath said. "Forget the White House. We can't wait any longer. We need to do something right now, people. 6 hours from now, the whole situation blows right out of control. We'll lose her."
6 hours is 360 minutes. They wasted the first 2 sitting in silence. Johnson stared into space. Webster drummed his fingers on the table. Garber stared at McGrath, a wry expression on his face. McGrath was staring at the map. Milosevic and Brogan were standing in the silence, holding the brown bags of breakfast and the styrofoam cups.
"Coffee here, anybody wants it," Brogan said.
Garber waved him over.
"Eat and plan," he said.
"Map?"
Johnson said. McGrath slid the map across the table. They all sat forward, back in motion. 358 minutes to go.
"Ravine's about 4 miles north of us," the aide said. "All we got is 8 Marines and a LAV-25.
"That tank thing?"
McGrath asked. The aide shook his head.
"Light armored vehicle," he said. "LAV. 8 wheels, no tracks."
"Bulletproof?"
Webster asked.
"For sure," the aide said. "They can drive it all the way to York."
"If it gets through the ravine," Garber said.
Johnson nodded.
"That's the big question," he said. "We need to go take a look."
The light armored vehicle looked just like a tank to McGrath's hasty civilian glance, except there were 8 wheels on it instead of tracks. The hull was welded up out of brutal sloping armor plates, and there was a turret with a gun. The driver sat forward and the commander sat in the turret. In the rear, 2 rows of 3 Marines sat back to back, facing weapon ports. Each port had its own periscope. McGrath could visualize the vehicle rumbling into battle, invulnerable, weapons bristling out of those ports. down into the ravine, up the other side, along the road to York, to the courthouse. He pulled Webster to one side and spoke urgently.
"We never told him," he said, "about the dynamite in the walls."
"And we're not going to," Webster said quietly. "The old guy would freak out. He's close to falling apart right now. I'm going to tell the Marines direct. They're going in there. They'll have to deal with it. Makes no difference if Johnson knows in advance or not."
McGrath intercepted Johnson, and Webster ran over to the armored vehicle. McGrath saw the Marine commander leaning down from the turret, saw him nodding and grimacing as Webster spoke. Then the general's aide fired up the Army Chevrolet. Johnson and Garber crammed into the front bench with them. McGrath jumped in back. Brogan and Milosevic crushed in alongside him. Webster finished up and raced back to the Chevy, squeezed in next to Milosevic. The LAV fired up its big diesel with a blast of black smoke. Then it crunched into gear and lumbered off north. The Chevy accelerated in its wake. 4 miles north, they crested a slight rise and entered a curve, slowed and jammed to a stop in the lee of a craggy outcrop. The Marine commander vaulted down from the turret and ran north on the road. Webster and Johnson and McGrath got out and hurried after him. They paused together in the lee of the rock face and crept around the curve, stared out and down into the ravine. It was an intimidating sight. It ran left to right in front of them, more or less straight, and it was not just a trench. It was a trench and a step. The whole crust of the earth had fractured, and the southern plate had fallen below the level of the northern plate, like adjacent sections of an old concrete highway where a car thumps up an inch at the seam. Expanded to geological size, that inch was a 50-foot disparity. Where the earth had fractured and fallen, the edges had broken up into giant boulders. The scouring of the glaciers had tumbled those boulders south. The ice and the heave and the weather over a million years had raked out the fracture and turned it into a trench. It had cut back the rock plates to where they became solid again. Some places it had carved 100-yard width. Other places, tougher seams of rock had kept the gap down to 20 yards. Then the roots of 1,000 generations of trees and the frozen water of the winters had eroded the edges until there was a steep, ragged descent to the bottom and a steep, ragged rise back up the northern side to the top, 50 feet higher than the starting point. There were stunted trees and tangled undergrowth and rock slides. The road itself was lifted progressively on concrete trestles and rose gently across a bridge. Then more concrete trestles set it down on the level ground to the north, and it snaked away through the forest into the mountains. But the bridge was blown. Charges had been exploded against the two centered trestles. A 20-foot section of the center span had fallen 100 feet into the trench. The four men in the lee of the outcrop could see fragments of the road lying shattered in the bottom of the ravine. "What do you think?" Johnson asked urgently. The Marine commander was giving it a fast sweep through his field glasses, left and right, up and down, examining the exact terrain.
"I think it's shit, sir," he said.
"Can you get through?" Johnson asked him. The guy lowered his field glasses and shook his head.
"Not a hope in hell," he said.
He stepped across, shoulder to shoulder with the general, so Johnson could share the same line of sight, started talking rapidly and pointing as he did so.
"We could get down to the bottom," he said. "We could go in right there, where the rock slide gives us a reasonable descent. But getting up the other side is a problem, sir. The LAV can't climb much more than 45 degrees. Most of the north face looks a lot steeper than that. Some places it's near enough vertical. Any gentle slopes are overgrown, and they felled trees. See there, sir?"
He pointed to a wooded area on the slope opposite. Trees had been felled and left lying with their chopped ends facing south.
"Abatises," the Marine said. "The vehicle is going to stall against them. No doubt about that. Coming uphill, slowly, those things would stop a tank. We go in there, we'll be trapped in the ditch. No doubt at all."
"So what the hell do we do?" Johnson said. The Marine officer shrugged. Bring me some engineers, he said. The gap they blew is only about 20 feet wide. We can bridge that.
How long will that take? Webster asked. The Marine shrugged again.
All the way up here? He said. 6 hours? Maybe 8?
Way too long, Webster said.
Then the radio receiver in McGrath's pocket started crackling. 39. Reacher was hiding out in the woods, worried about the dogs. They were the only thing he wasn't certain about. People, he could handle. Dogs, he had very little experience. He was in the trees, north of the bastion, south of the rifle range. He had heard the Chinook hit the ground from a mile away. It hit tail first, smashing and tearing into the wooded slope. It looked to have slipped sideways in the air and missed the courthouse by 200 yards. No explosions. Not from the courthouse or from the chopper itself. No sound of fuel tanks going up. Reacher was reasonably optimistic for the crew. He figured the trees and the collapse of the big boxy body might have cushioned the impact for them. He had known chopper crews survive worse. He had an M16 rifle in his hand and a Glock in his pocket. The Glock was fully loaded, 17 shells. The M16 had the short clip, 20 shells, less the one that had killed the guy with the missile. The second M16 had the long clip, a full load of 30. But it was hidden in the trees, because Reacher had a rule. Choose the weapon you know for certain is in working order. He felt instinctively that the focus of attention would be in the southeast direction. That was where Holly was being held, and that was where the Chinook had come down. That was where the opposition forces would be massing. He felt people would be turning to face southeast, apprehensively, staring down into the rest of the United States, waiting. So he turned his back and headed northwest. He moved cautiously. The bulk of the enemy was elsewhere, but he knew there were squads out looking for him. He knew they had already discovered Fowler's body. He had seen 2 separate patrols searching the woods, 6 men in each, heavily armed, crashing through the undergrowth, searching. Not difficult to avoid. But the dogs would be difficult to avoid. That was why he was worried. That was why he was moving cautiously. He stayed in the trees and skirted the western end of the rifle range, tracked back east around the parade ground. 50 yards north, he turned again and paralleled the road up to the mines. He stayed in the trees and moved at a fast jog, used the time to start laying out some priorities and a time scale. He figured he had maybe 3 hours. Bringing down the Chinook was going to provoke some kind of a violent reaction. No doubt about that. But in all his years in the service, he had never known anything to happen faster than 3 hours. So he had 3 hours, and a lot of ground to cover. He slowed to a fast walk when the rocky ground started rising under his feet, followed a wide uphill circle west, and cut straight into the edge of the bowl where the mine entrances were. He heard diesel engines idling. He bent double and crept across to the cover of a rock, looked out, and down. He was just about halfway up the slope surrounding the bowl, looking more or less due east across its diameter. The log doors of the father's shed were standing open. 4 of the missile unit's trucks were standing on the shale, the 4 with the weapon racks in back. The troop carrier was still inside. There was a handful of men in the bowl. They were set in an approximate circle around the cluster of trucks. Reacher counted 8 guys, fatigues, rifles, tense limbs. What had the kitchen woman said? The mines were off limits, except to the people Borkin trusted. Reacher watched them. 8 trusted lieutenants, acting out a reasonable imitation of sentry duty. He watched them for a couple of minutes, slid his rifle to his shoulder. He was less than 100 yards away. He could hear the rattle of the shale as the sentries moved around. He clicked the selector to the single-shot position. He had 19 shells in the box, and he needed to fire a minimum of 8. He needed to be cautious with ammunition. The M16 is a good rifle. Easy to use, easy to maintain, easy to aim. The carrying handle has a grooved top, which lines up with an identical groove in the front sight. At 100 yards, you squint down the handle groove and let it merge with the front groove, and what you see is what you hit. Reacher rested his weight on the rock and lined up the first target, practiced the slight sweep that would take him onto the second and the third. He rehearsed the full sequence of 8 shots. He didn't want his elbow snagging somewhere in the middle. He returned to the first target, waited a beat, and fired. The sound of the shot crashed through the mountains. The right front tire of the first truck exploded. He swept the sights onto the left front, fired again. The truck dropped to its rims like a stunned ox falling to its knees. He kept firing steadily. He had fired 5 shots and hit 5 tires before anybody reacted. As he fired the 6th, he saw in the corner of his eye the sentries diving for cover. Some were just dropping to the ground, others were running for the shed. He fired the 7th, paused before the 8th. The farthest tire was the hardest shot. The angle was oblique. The sidewall was unavailable to him. He was going to have to fire at the treads. Possible that the shell might glance off. He fired. He hit. The tire burst. The front of the last truck dropped. The nearest sentry was still on his feet, not heading for the shed, just standing and staring toward the rock Reacher was behind, raising his rifle. It was an M16, same as Reacher's. Long magazine, 30 shells. The guy was standing there, sighting it in on the rock. A brave man. Or an idiot. Reacher crouched and waited. The guy fired. His weapon was set on automatic. He loosed off a burst of 3. 3 shots in a 1/5 of a second. They smashed into the trees 15 feet above Reacher's head. Twigs and leaves drifted down and landed near him. The guy ran 10 yards closer, fired again. 3 more shells, way off to Reacher's left. He heard the whine of the bullets and the thunking as they hit the trees before he heard the muzzle blast. Bullets which travel faster than sound do that. You hear it all in reverse order. The bullet gets there before the sound of the shot. Reacher had decisions to take. How close was he going to let this guy get? And was he going to fire a warning shot? The next burst of 3 was nearer. Low, but nearer. Not more than 6 feet away. Reacher decided, not much damn closer. And no warning shot. The guy was all pumped up. No percentage in trying a warning shot. This guy was not going to get calmed down in any kind of a hurry. He lay on his side, straightened his legs, and came out at the base of the rock. Fired once and hit the guy in the chest. He went down in a heap on the shale. The rifle flew off to his right. Reacher stayed where he was, watched carefully. The guy was still alive, so Reacher fired again, hit him through the top of the head. Kinder not to leave him with a sucking chest wound for the last 10 minutes of his life. The echoes of the brief firefight died into the mountain silence, and then the air was still. The other 7 guys were nowhere. The trucks were all resting nose down on their front rims, disabled. Maybe they could be driven out of the bowl, but the first of the mountain hairpins was going to strip the blown tires right off. The trucks were neutralized. No doubt about that. Reacher crawled backward 10 yards and stood up in the trees, jogged down the slope and headed back toward the bastion. 17 shells in the Glock, 9 in the rifle. Progress at a price. The dogs found him halfway back. 2 big rangy animals, German shepherds. He saw them at the same time as they saw him. They were loping along with that kind of infinite energy big dogs display. Long, bounding strides, eager expressions, wet mouths gaping. They stopped short on stiff front legs and switched direction in a single fluid stride. 30 yards away, then 20, then 10. Acceleration, new energy in their movement, snarls rising in their throats. People, Reacher was certain about. Dogs were different. People had freedom of choice. If a man or a woman ran snarling toward him, they did so because they chose to. They were asking for whatever they got. His response was their problem. But dogs were different. No free will, easily misled. It raised an ethical problem. Shooting a dog because it had been induced to do something unwise was not the sort of thing Reacher wanted to do. He left the Glock in his pocket. The rifle was better. It was about 2.5 feet longer than the handgun. An extra 2.5 feet of separation seemed like a good idea. The dogs stopped short of him. The fur on their shoulders was raised. The fur down their backs was raised, following their spines. They crouched, front feet splayed, heads down, snarling loudly. They had yellowed teeth. Lots of them. Their eyes were brown. Reacher could see fine, dark eyelashes, like a girl's. One of them was forward of the other, the leader of the pack. He knew dogs had to have a pecking order. Two dogs, one of them had to be superior to the other. Like people. He didn't know how dogs worked it out for themselves. Posturing, maybe. Maybe smell. Maybe fighting. He stared at the forward dog, stared into its eyes. Time to time he had heard people talking about dogs. They said, never show fear. Stare the dog down. Don't let it know you're afraid. Reacher wasn't afraid. He was standing there with an M16 in his hands. The only thing he was worried about was having to use it. He stared silently at the dog like he used to stare at some service guy gone bad. A hard, silent stare like a physical force, like a cold, crushing pressure. Bleak, cold eyes, unblinking. It had worked 100 times with people. Now it was working with the lead dog. The dog was only partially trained. Reacher could see that. It could go through the motions, but it couldn't deliver. It hadn't been trained to ignore its victim's input. It was eye to eye with him, backing off fractionally like his glare was a painful weight on its narrow forehead. Reacher turned up the temperature, narrowed his eyes, and bared his own teeth, sneered like a tough guy in a bad movie. The dog's head dropped. Its eyes swiveled upward to maintain contact. Its tail dropped down between its legs. Sit, Reacher said. He said it calmly, but firmly. Plenty of emphasis on the plosive consonant at the end of the word. The dog moved automatically, shuffled its hind legs inward and sat. The other dog followed suit like a shadow. They sat side by side and stared up at him. Lie down, Reacher said. The dogs didn't move, just stayed sitting, looking at him, puzzled. Maybe the wrong word, not the command they were accustomed to. Down, Reacher said. They slid their front paws forward and dropped their bellies to the forest floor, looking up at him. Stay, Reacher said. He gave them a look like he meant it and moved off south, forced himself to walk slow. 5 yards into the trees, he turned. The dogs were still on the ground. Their necks were twisted around, watching him walk away. Stay, he called again. They stayed. He walked. He could hear people in the bastion, the sound of a fair-sized crowd trying to keep quiet. He heard it when he was still north of the parade ground. He skirted the area in the trees and walked around the far end of the rifle range, came through the trees behind the mess hall, opposite the kitchen door. He walked a circle deep in the woods behind the buildings until he got an angle, crept forward to take a look. There were maybe 30 people in the bastion. They were standing in a tight group, edging forward into a cluster. All men, all in camouflage fatigues, all heavily armed. Rifles, machine guns, grenade launchers, pockets bulging with spare magazines. The crowd ebbed and flowed, shoulders touched and parted. Reacher glimpsed Bo Borkin in the center of the mass of people. He was holding a small, black radio transmitter. Reacher recognized it. It was Jackson's. Borkin had retrieved it from Fowler's pocket. He was holding it up to his ear, staring into space like he'd just switched it on, and was waiting for a reply. 40. McGrath snatched the radio from his pocket, flipped it open, and stared at it. It was crackling loudly in his hand. Webster stepped forward and took it from him, ducked back to the cover of the rock face and clicked the button.
"Jackson," he said, "this is Harlan Webster."
McGrath and Johnson crowded in on him. The three men crouched against the rock wall. Webster moved the unit an inch from his ear so the other two could listen in. In the cover of the rock, in the silence of the mountains, they could hear it crackling and hissing, and the fast breathing of a person on the other end. Then they heard a voice.
"Harlan Webster,"
the voice said.
"Well, well, the head man himself."
"Jackson?"
Webster said again.
"No,"
the voice said.
"This is not Jackson."
Webster glanced at McGrath.
"So who is it?" he asked.
"Bo Borkin,"
the voice said.
"And as of today, I guess that's President Borkin, President of the Free States of America. But feel free to speak informally."
"Where's Jackson?"
Webster asked. There was a pause. Nothing to hear except the faint electronic sound of FBI telecommunications technology, satellites, and microwaves.
"Where's Jackson?"
Webster asked again.
"He died,"
the voice said. Webster glanced at McGrath again.
"How?"
he asked.
"Just died,"
Borkin said.
"Relatively quickly, really."
"Was he sick?"
Webster asked. There was another pause. Then there was the sound of laughter, a high, tinny sound, a loud, shrieking laugh which overloaded Webster's earpiece and spilled into distortion and bounced off the rock wall.
"No, he wasn't sick, Webster,"
Borkin said.
"He was pretty healthy up until the last 10 minutes.
"What did you do to him?"
Webster asked.
"Same as I'm going to do to the general's little girl,"
Borkin said.
"Listen up, and I'll tell you the exact details. You need to pay attention, because you need to know what you're dealing with here. We're serious here. We mean business, you understand? You listening?"
Johnson pushed in close, white and sweating.
"You crazy bastards!" he yelled.
"Who's that?"
Borkin asked.
"That the general himself?"
"General Johnson," Webster said. There was a chuckle on the radio, just a short, satisfied sound.
"A full house,"
Borkin said.
"The director of the FBI and the joint chairman. Oh, we're flattered, believe me. But I guess the birth of a new nation deserves nothing less."
"What do you want?" Webster asked.
"We crucified him,"
Borkin said.
"We found a couple of trees a yard apart, and we nailed him up. We're going to do that to your daughter, General, if you step out of line. Then we cut his balls off. He was pleading and screaming for us not to, but we did it anyway. We can't do that to your kid, her being a woman and all, but we'll find some equivalent, you know what I mean? Do you think she'll be screaming and pleading, General? You know her better than me. Personally, I'm betting she will be. She likes to think she's a tough cookie, but when she sees those blades coming close, she's going to change her damn tune pretty quick. I'm just about sure of that."
Johnson turned whiter. All his blood just drained away. He fell back and sat heavily against the rock. His mouth was working soundlessly.
"What the hell do you bastards want?"
Webster yelled. There was another silence. Then the voice came back, quiet and firm.
"I want you to stop yelling,"
it said.
"I want you to apologize for yelling at me. I want you to apologize for calling me a rude name. I'm the President of the Free States, and I'm owed some courtesy and deference, wouldn't you say?"
His voice was quiet, but McGrath heard it clearly enough. He looked across at Webster in panic. They were close to losing before they had even started. First rule was to negotiate, to keep them talking and gradually gain the upper hand, establish dominance, classic siege theory. but to start out by apologizing for yelling was to kiss goodbye to any hope of dominance. That was to lie down and roll over. From that point on, you were their plaything. McGrath shook his head urgently. Webster nodded back, said nothing, just held the radio without speaking. He knew how to do this. He had been in this situation before, several times. He knew the protocol. Now, the first one to speak was the weaker one, and it wasn't going to be him. He and McGrath gazed at the ground and waited.
"You still there?"
Borken asked. Webster kept on staring down, saying nothing.
"You there?"
Borken said again.
"What's on your mind, Bo?"
Webster asked calmly. There was angry breathing over the air.
"You cut my phone line,"
Borken said.
"I want it restored."
"No, we didn't," Webster said. "Doesn't your phone work?"
"My faxes,"
Borken said.
"I got no response."
"What faxes?" Webster said.
"Don't bullshit me,"
Borken said.
"I know you cut the line. I want it fixed."
Webster winked at McGrath.
"Okay," he said. "We can do that, but you've got to do something for us first."
"What?"
Borken asked.
"Holly," Webster said. "Bring her down to the bridge and leave her there."
There was another silence, then the laughter started up again, high and loud.
"No dice,"
Borken said.
"And no deals."
Webster nodded to himself, lowered his voice, sounded like the most reasonable man on earth.
"Listen, Mr. Borken," he said. "If we can't deal, how can we help each other?"
Another silence. McGrath stared at Webster. The next reply was crucial. Win or lose.
"You listen to me, Webster,"
the voice said.
"No deals. You don't do exactly what I say, Holly dies. In a lot of pain. I hold all the cards, and I'm not doing deals. You understand that?"
Webster's shoulders slumped. McGrath looked away.
"Restore the fax line,"
the voice said.
"I need communications. The world must know what we're doing here. This is a big moment in history, Webster. I won't be denied by your stupid games. The world must witness the first blows being struck against your tyranny."
Webster stared at the ground.
"This decision is too big for you alone,"
Borken said.
"You need to consult with the White House. There's an interest there, too, wouldn't you say?"
Even over the tinny, handheld radio, the force of Borken's voice was obvious. Webster was flinching like a physical weight was against his ear, flinching and gasping as his heart and lungs fought each other for space inside his chest.
"Make your decision,"
Borken said.
"I'll call back in 2 minutes.
Then the radio went dead. Webster stared at it like he had never seen such a piece of equipment before. McGrath leaned over and clicked the button off.
"Okay," he said. "We stall, right? Tell him we're fixing the line. Tell him it will take an hour, maybe two. Tell him we're in contact with the White House, the UN, CNN, whoever. Tell him whatever the hell he wants to hear."
"Why is he doing this?" Webster asked vaguely. "Escalating everything. He's making it so we have to attack him. So we have to, right? Like he wants us to. He's giving us no choice. He's provoking us."
"He's doing it because he's crazy," McGrath said.
"He must be," Webster said. "He's a maniac. Otherwise, I just can't understand why he's trying to attract so much attention. Because, like he says, he holds all the cards already."
"We'll worry about that later, Chief," McGrath said. "Right now, we just need to stall him."
Webster nodded, forced himself back to the problem in hand.
"But we need longer than 2 hours," he said. "Hostage rescue will take at least 4 to get over here. Maybe 5, maybe 6. "Okay, it's the 4th of July," McGrath said. "Tell him the linemen are all off duty. Tell him it could take us all day to get them back."
They stared at each other, glanced at Johnson. He was right out of it, just slumped against the rock face, white and inert, barely breathing. 90 hours of mortal stress and emotion had finally broken him. Then the radio in Webster's hand crackled again.
Well?
Borkin asked when the static cleared.
Okay, we agree, Webster said. We'll fix the line, but it's going to take some time. Linemen are off duty for the holidays.
There was a pause, then a chuckle.
Independence Day,
Borkin said.
Oh, maybe I should have chosen another date.
Webster made no reply.
I want your Marines where I can see them,
Borkin said.
What Marines? Webster said.
There was another short laugh, short and complacent.
You've got 8 Marines,
Borkin said.
And an armored car. We got lookouts all over the place. We've been watching you, like you're watching us with those damn planes. Your lucky Stingers don't shoot that high, or you'd have more than a damn helicopter on the ground by now.
Webster made no reply, just scanned the horizon. McGrath was doing the same thing, automatically, looking for the glint of the sun on field glasses.
I figure you're close to the bridge right now,
Borkin said.
Am I right?
Webster shrugged. McGrath prompted him with a nod.
We're close to the bridge, Webster said.
I want the Marines on the bridge,
Borkin said.
Sitting on the edge, in a neat little row, their vehicle behind them. I want that to happen now, you understand? Or we go to work on Holly. Your choice, Webster. Or maybe it's the General's choice. His daughter and his Marines, right?
Johnson roused himself and glanced up. 5 minutes later, the Marines were sitting on the fractured edge of the roadway, feet dangling down into the abyss. Their lav was parked up behind them. Webster was still in the lee of the rock face with McGrath and Johnson, the radio still pressed to his ear. He could hear muffled sounds, like Borkin had pressed his hand over the microphone and was using a walkie-talkie. He could hear his muffled voice alternating with crackly replies. Then he heard the hand come away and the voice come back again, loud and clear in the earpiece.
Okay, Webster, good work,
Borkin said to him.
Our scouts can see all 8 of them. So can our riflemen. If they move, they die. Who else have you got there with you?
Webster paused. McGrath shook his head urgently.
Well, can't you see? Webster asked. I thought you were watching us.
Not right now,
Borkin said.
I pulled my people back a little, into our defensive positions.
There's nobody else here, Webster said. Just me and the General.
There was another pause.
Okay. You 2 can join the Marines,
Borkin said.
On the bridge, on the end of the line.
Webster waited for a long moment, a blank expression on his face. Then he got up and nodded to Johnson. Johnson got up unsteadily, and the 2 of them walked forward together around the curve, left McGrath on his own, crouched in the lee of the rock. McGrath waited there 2 minutes and crawled back south to the Chevrolet. Garber and Johnson's aide were in front, and Milosevic and Brogan were in back. They were all staring at him.
What the hell happened?
Brogan asked.
We're in deep, deep shit, McGrath said.
2 minutes of hurried explanation, and the others agreed with him.
So what now?
Garber asked.
We go get Holly, McGrath said, before he realizes we're bullshitting him.
But how?
Brogan asked. McGrath glanced at him, glanced at Milosevic.
The 3 of us, he said. End of the day, this is a bureau affair. Call it whatever you want. Terrorism, sedition, kidnapping. It's all FBI territory.
We're going to do it,
Milosevic said.
Just the 3 of us, right now?
You got a better way? McGrath said. You want something done properly, you do it yourself, right?
Garber was twisted around, scanning along the 3 faces on the rear bench.
So go do it, he said.
McGrath nodded and held up his right hand, the thumb and the first two fingers sticking out.
"I'm the thumb," he said. "I go in east of the road. Brogan, you're the first finger. You walk a mile west of the road and go in from there. Milo, you're the second finger. You walk 2 miles west and go north from there. We infiltrate separately, spaced out a mile between each of us. We meet up back on the road a half mile shy of the town. Clear?"
Brogan made a face, then he nodded. Milosevic shrugged. Garber glanced at McGrath, and the general's aide started the Chevy and rolled it gently south. He stopped it again after 400 yards, where the road came back out of the rock cover, and there was clear access left and right into the countryside. The three FBI men checked their weapons. They each had a government issue 38 in a shiny brown leather shoulder holster, full load of six, plus another six in a speed loader in their pockets.
"Try to capture a couple of rifles," McGrath said. "Don't worry about taking prisoners. You see somebody, you shoot the bastard down, okay?"
Milosevic had the longest walk, so he was first to go. He ducked across the road and struck out due west across the mountain scrub. He made it to a small stand of trees and disappeared. McGrath lit a cigarette and sent Brogan after him. Garber waited until Brogan was in the trees, then he turned back to McGrath.
"Don't forget what I told you about Reacher," he said. "I'm not wrong about that guy. He's on your side. Believe me."
McGrath shrugged and said nothing, smoked in silence, opened the Chevy's door and slid out, ground out the cigarette under his shoe, and walked away east, across the grassy shoulder and onto the scrub. McGrath was not far off 50 and a heavy smoker, but he was a fit man. He had that type of mongrel constitution that age and smoke could not hurt. He was short at 5'7", but sturdy. About 160, made up of that hard, slabby muscle which needs no maintenance and never fades into fat. He felt the same as he had as a kid. No better, no worse. His bureau training had been a long time ago and fairly rudimentary compared to what people were getting now. But he'd aced it. Physically, he'd been indestructible. Not the fastest guy in his class, but easily the best stamina. The training runs in the early days of Quantico had been crude, around and around in the Virginia woods, using natural obstacles. McGrath would come in maybe third or fourth every time. But if they were sent around again, he could do the same exact time, just about to the second. The faster guys would be struggling at his side as he pounded relentlessly onward. Then they would fall back. Second time around, McGrath would come in first. Third time around, he would be the only guy to finish. So he was jogging comfortably as he approached the southern edge of the ravine. He had worked about 300 yards east to a point where the slopes were reasonable and not directly overlooked. He went straight down without pausing, short, stiff strides against the incline. The footing was loose. He skidded on small avalanches of gravel and used the stunted trees to check his speed. He dodged around the litter of rocks in the bottom of the trench and started up the northern slope. Going up was harder. He kicked his toes into the gravel for grip and hauled himself upward with handfuls of grass. He zigzagged between the small trees and bushes looking for leverage. The extra 50 feet on the northern rim was a punishment. He tracked right to where a small landslide had created a straight path at a kinder angle, slipped and slid upward through the crushed rock to the top. He waited in the overhang, where the earth had fallen away beneath the crust of roots, listened hard, heard nothing except silence. He lifted himself onto the rim, stood there with his chest against the earth, head and shoulders exposed, looking north into enemy territory. He saw nothing, just the gentle initial slopes, then the hills, then the giant mountains glowering in the far distance. Blue sky, a million trees, clean air, total silence. He thought, "You're a long way from Chicago, Mac." Ahead of him was a belt of scrub where the ancient rock was too close to the surface for much to grow. Then a ragged belt of trees, interrupted at first by rocky outcrops, then growing denser into the distance. He could see the curved gap in the treetops where the road must run. 300 yards to his left.
He rolled up onto the grass and ran for the trees, worked left toward the road, and shadowed it north in the forest. He jogged along, dodging trees like a slow-motion parody of a wide receiver heading for the end zone. The map was printed in his mind. He figured he had maybe 3 miles to go. 3 miles at a slow jog, not much better than a fast walk, maybe 45, 50 minutes. The ground was rising gently under his feet. Every fourth or fifth stride, his feet hit the floor a fraction sooner than they should have as the gradient lifted him into the hills. He tripped a couple of times on roots. Once he slammed into a pine trunk, but he pounded on, relentlessly. After 40 minutes, he stopped. He figured Brogan and Milosevic were having a similar journey, but they were dealing with extra distance because they had tracked west at the outset, so he expected a delay. With luck, they would be about 20 minutes behind him. He walked deeper into the woods and sat down against a trunk, lit a cigarette. He figured he was maybe a half mile shy of the rendezvous. The map in his head said the road was about due to arrow up into the town. He waited 15 minutes, 2 cigarettes. Then he stood up and walked on. He went cautiously. He was getting close. He made 2 diversions to his left and found the road. Just crept through the trees until he caught the gleam of sun on the gray cement. Then he dodged back and continued north. He walked until he saw the forest thinning ahead. He saw sunlight on open spaces beyond the last trees. He stopped and stepped left and right to find a view. He saw the road running up to the town. He saw buildings. A gray ruin on a knoll on the left. The courthouse on the right. Better preserved. Gleaming white in the sunshine. He stared through the trees at it for a long moment. Then he turned back. Paced 500 yards back into the woods. Drifted over toward the road until he could just make out the gray gleam through the trees. Leaned on a trunk. And waited for Brogan and Milosevic. This time he resisted the attraction of another cigarette. He had learned a long time ago that to smoke while in hiding was not a smart thing to do. The smell drifts, and a keen nose can detect it. So he leaned on the tree and stared down in frustration, stared at his shoes. They were ruined from the scramble up the north face of the ravine. He had jabbed them hard into the rocky slope, and they were scratched to pieces. He stared at the ruined toe caps and instantly knew he had been betrayed. Panic rose in his throat. His chest seized hard. It hit him like a prison door swinging gently shut. It swung soundlessly inward on greased hinges and clanged shut right in his face. What had Borkin said on the radio? He had said, "Like you're watching us with those damn planes." But what had the general's aide told him back in the Butte office? You look up, and you see a tiny vapor trail, and you think it's TWA. You don't think it's the Air Force checking if you've shined your shoes this morning. So how did Borkin know there were surveillance planes in the sky? Because he had been told. But by who? Who the hell knew? He glanced around, wildly, and the first thing he saw was a dog coming at him from dead ahead, then another. They bounded through the trees at him. He heard a sound from behind him. The crunch of feet and the flick of branches, then the same sound from his right. The snicking and slapping of a weapon from his left. The dogs were at his feet. He spun in a panic-stricken circle. All around him, men were coming at him through the trees. Lean, bearded men in camouflage gear, carrying rifles and machine guns. Grenades slung from their webbing. Maybe 15 or 20 men. They stepped forward calmly and purposefully. They were in a complete ring right around him. He turned one way, then the other. He was surrounded. They were raising their weapons. He had 15 or 20 automatic weapons pointing straight at him like spokes in a wheel. They stood silent, weapons ready. McGrath glanced from one to the next in a complete wild circle. Then one of them stepped forward, some kind of an officer. His hand went straight in under McGrath's jacket, jerked the .38 out of its holster. Then the guy's hand went into McGrath's pocket, closed over the speed loader, and pulled it out. The guy slipped both items into his own pocket and smiled, swung his fist and hit McGrath in the face. McGrath staggered and was prodded back forward with the muzzle of a rifle. Then he heard tires on the road, the grumble of a motor. He glanced left and caught a flash of olive green in the sun. A jeep. Two men in it. The soldiers pressed in and forced him out of the forest. They jostled him through the trees and onto the shoulder. He blinked in the sun. He could feel his nose was bleeding. The jeep rolled forward and stopped alongside him. The driver stared at him with curiosity. Another lean, bearded man in uniform. In the passenger seat was a huge man wearing black. Bo Borken. McGrath recognized him from his bureau file photograph. He stared at him. Then Borken leaned over and grinned.
"Hello, Mr. McGrath," he said. "You made good time."
41. Reacher watched the whole thing happen. He was 150 yards away in the trees, northwest of the ambush, high up the slope on the other side of the road. There was a dead sentry at his feet. The guy was lying in the dirt with his head at right angles to his neck. Reacher had his field glasses raised to his eyes, watching. Watching what? He wasn't exactly sure. He had caught the gist of the radio conversation in the bastion. He had heard Borken's side. He had guessed the replies. He had heard the southern lookouts calling in on the walkie-talkies. He knew about the Marines on the bridge. He knew about Webster and Johnson sitting there alongside them, on the end of the line. He had wondered who else was down there. Maybe more military, maybe more FBI. The military wouldn't come. Johnson would have ordered them to sit tight. If anybody came, it would be the FBI. He figured they might have substantial numbers standing by. He figured they would be coming in sooner or later. He needed to exploit them, needed to use them as a diversion while he got Holly out. So he had moved southeast to wait for their arrival. Now, an hour later, he was gazing down at the short, stocky guy getting loaded into the jeep. Dark suit, white shirt, town shoes. FBI for sure. But not the hostage rescue team. This guy had no equipment. The HRT came in all loaded down with paramilitary gear. Reacher was familiar with their procedures. He had read some of their manuals, heard about some of their training. He knew guys who had been in and out of Quantico. He knew how the HRT worked. They were a high-technology operation. They looked like regular soldiers, in blue. They had vehicles. This guy he was watching was on foot in the forest, dressed like he had just stepped out of a meeting. It was a puzzle. 8 Marines, no hostage rescue team, an unarmed search-and-rescue Chinook. Then Reacher suddenly thought maybe he understood. Maybe this was a very clandestine operation. Low profile. Invisible. They had tracked Holly all the way west from Chicago, but for some reason they maybe weren't gathering any kind of a big force. They were dealing with it alone. Some tactical reason. Maybe a political reason. Maybe something to do with Holly and the White House. Maybe the policy was to deal with this secretly, deal with it hard, tackle it with a tight little team. So tight, the right hand didn't know what the left was doing, hence the unarmed search and rescue chopper. It had come in blind, hadn't known what it was getting into. In which case, this ambushed guy he was watching was direct from Chicago, part of the original operation that must have started up back on Monday. He looked like a senior guy, maybe approaching 50. Could be Brogan, Holly's section head. Could even be McGrath, the top boy. In either case, that made Milosevic the mole. Question was he up here as well, or was he still back in Chicago? The jeep turned slowly in the road. The bureau guy in the suit was in back, jammed between two armed men. His nose was bleeding, and Reacher could see a swelling starting on his face. Borken had twisted his bulk around and was talking at him. The rest of the ambush squad was forming up in the road. The jeep drove past them, north toward town, passed by 30 yards from where Reacher was standing in the trees. He watched it go, turned and picked up his rifle, strolled through the woods, deep in thought. His problem was priority order. He had a rule: stick to the job in hand. The job in hand was getting Holly away safe. Nothing else.
But this bureau guy was in trouble. He thought about Jackson, the last bureau guy they'd gotten hold of. Maybe this new guy was heading for the same fate. In which case, he ought to intervene. And he liked the look of the guy. He looked tough, small but strong, a lot of energy, some kind of charisma there. Maybe an ally would be a smart thing to have. Two heads, better than one. Two pairs of hands, four trigger fingers. Useful. But his rule was, stick to the job in hand. It had worked for him many times over the years. It was a rule which had served him well. Should he bend that rule? Or not? He stopped and stood concealed in the forest while the ambush squad marched by on the road, listened to the sound of their footsteps die away, stood there and thought about the guy some more, and forced himself toward a tough decision. General Garber watched the whole thing happen, too. He was 150 yards south of the ambush, west side of the road, behind a rocky outcrop, exactly 300 yards south of where Reacher had been. He had waited 3 minutes and then followed McGrath in through the ravine. Garber was also a reasonably fit man, but a little older, and it had cost him a lot to keep pace with McGrath. He had arrived at the rocky outcrop and collapsed, out of breath. He figured he had maybe 15 or 20 minutes to recover before the rendezvous took place. Then his plan was to follow behind the three agents and see what was going to happen. He didn't want anybody making mistakes about Jack Reacher. But the rendezvous had never happened. He had watched the ambush and realized a lot of mistakes had been made about a lot of things.
"You're going to die," Borken said.
McGrath was jammed between two soldiers on the back seat of the jeep. He was bouncing around because the road was rough, but he couldn't move his arms because the seat was not really wide enough for three people. So he put the shrug into his injured face instead.
"We're all going to die," he said, "sooner or later."
"Sooner or later, right," Borken said. "But for you, it's going to be sooner, not later."
Borken was twisted around in the front seat, staring. McGrath looked past him at the vast blue sky. He looked at the small white clouds and thought, who was it? Who knew? Air Force operational personnel, he guessed. But that link was ludicrous. Had to be somebody nearer and closer, somebody more involved. The only possibilities were Johnson or his aide, or Webster himself, or Brogan, or Milosevic. Garber, conceivably. He seemed pretty hot on excusing this Reacher guy. Was this some military police conspiracy to overthrow the Joint Chiefs?
Who was it, Borken? He asked.
Who was what, dead man?
Borken asked back.
Who's been talking to you? McGrath said.
Borken smiled and tapped his finger on his temple.
Common cause, he said. This sort of issue, there are a lot more people than you think on our side.
McGrath glanced back to the sky and thought about Dexter, safe in the White House. What had Webster said he'd said? 12 million people? Or was it 66 million?
You're going to die,
Borken said again. McGrath shifted his focus back.
So tell me who it was before I do, he said.
Borken grinned at him.
You'll find out, he said. It's going to be a big surprise.
The jeep pulled up in front of the courthouse. McGrath twisted and looked up at it. There were six soldiers standing guard outside the building. They were fanned into a rough arc, facing south and east.
She in there? He asked.
Borken nodded and smiled.
Right now she is, he said. I may have to get her out later.
The walkie-talkie on his belt burst into life. A loud burst of static and a quick, distorted message. He pressed the key and bent his head down, acknowledged the information without unclipping the unit. Then he pulled the radio transmitter from his pocket, flipped it open and pulled up the short antenna, pressed the send button.
Webster, he said, you lied to me. Twice. First, there were three of your agents down there with you. We just rounded them all up.
He listened to the response. Kept the radio tight against his ear. McGrath could not hear what Webster was saying.
Doesn't matter anyway, Borken said. They weren't all on your side. Some people in this world will do anything for money.
He paused for a response. Apparently there was none.
And you bullshitted me,
Borkin said.
You weren't going to fix the line at all, were you? You were just stringing me along.
Webster was starting reply, but Borkin cut him off.
You and Johnson,
he said,
you can get off the bridge now. The Marines stay there. We're watching. You and Johnson walk back to your trucks. Get yourselves in front of those TVs. Should be some interesting action pretty soon.
He clicked off the radio and folded it back into his pocket, a big, wide smile on his face.
You're going to die,
he said to McGrath for the third time.
Which one? McGrath asked. Brogan or Milosevic?
Borkin grinned again.
Yes, he said. Figure it out for yourself. You're supposed to be the big, smart federal investigator, agent in charge, right?
The driver jumped down and pulled a pistol from his holster, aimed it two-handed at McGrath's head. The left-hand guard squeezed out and unslung his rifle, held it ready. The right-hand guy did the same. Then Borkin eased his bulk down.
Out,
he said.
We walk from here.
McGrath shrugged and eased himself down into the circle of weapons. Borkin stepped behind him and caught his arms, cuffed his wrists together behind his back. Then he shoved him forward, pointed beyond the ruined county office.
Up there, dead man,
he said. They left the jeep behind them next to the courthouse. The two guards formed up. McGrath stumbled across the street and up onto the lumpy knoll. He was pushed past the dead tree. He was pushed left until he found the path. He followed it around behind the old building. The rough ground bit up through the thin soles of his ruined city shoes. He might as well have been walking barefoot.
Faster, asshole,
Borkin grunted at him. The guards were behind him, prodding him forward with the muzzles of their rifles. He picked up the pace and stumbled on through the woods. He felt the blood clotting on his lip and nose. After a mile, he came out into the clearing he recognized from the surveillance pictures. It looked bigger. From 7 miles overhead, it had looked like a neat hole in the trees with a tidy circle of buildings. From ground level, it looked as big as a stadium. Rough shale on the floor of the clearing, big wooden huts propped expertly on solid concrete piles.
Wait here,
Borkin said. He walked away, and the two guards took up station either side of McGrath as he gazed around. He saw the communications hut with the phone wire and the whip antenna. He saw the other buildings, smelled stale institutional food coming out of the largest, saw the farthest hut standing on its own. Must be their armory, he thought. He glanced up and saw the vapor trails in the sky. The urgency of the situation was written up there, white on blue. The planes had abandoned their innocent east-west trawling. Their trails had tightened into continuous circles, one just inside the other. They were flying around and around, centered 7 miles above his head. He stared up at them and mouthed, "Help!" He wondered if their lenses were good enough to pick that out. Wondered if maybe Webster or Johnson or Garber or Johnson's gopher could lip-read. His best guess was yes and no. Reacher's problem was a hell of an irony. For the first time in his life, he wished his opponents were better shots. He was concealed in the trees 100 yards northwest of the courthouse, looking down at 6 sentries. They were ranged in a loose arc to the south and east beyond the big white building. Reacher's rifle was trained on the nearest man, but he wasn't shooting, because if he did, the 6 men were going to shoot back, and they were going to miss. Reacher was happy with an M16 in a range of 100 yards. He could pretty much absolutely guarantee to hit what he wanted with that weapon at that range. He would bet his life on it. Many times he had. And normally, the worse shots his opponents were, the happier he'd be about it. But not in this situation. He would be shooting from a northwest direction. His opponents would be shooting back from the southeast. They would hear his shots, maybe see some muzzle flash. They would take aim and they would fire, and they would miss. They would shoot high and wide. The targets on the rifle range were mute evidence for that conclusion. There had been some competent shooting at 300 and 400 yards. The damaged targets bore witness to that fact. But Reacher's experience was that guys who could shoot just about competently at 300 or 400 yards on a range would be useless in a firefight. Lying still on a mat and sighting in on a target in your own time was one thing. Shooting into a noisy, confused hailstorm of bullets was a very different thing. A different thing entirely. The guy defending the missile trucks had proved that. His salvos had been all over the place. And that was the problem. Shooting back from the southeast, these guys' stray rounds were going to be all over the place, too. Up and down, left and right. The down rounds and the left rounds were no problem. They were just going to damage the scrubby vegetation. But the up rounds and the right rounds were going to hit the courthouse. The M16 uses bullets designated M855. Common NATO rounds, 5.56 millimeters in caliber, just a fraction under a quarter inch wide. Fairly heavy for their size, because they're a sandwich of lead and steel inside a copper jacket, designed for penetration. Those stray rounds which hit the courthouse were going to impact the siding at 2,000 miles an hour. They were going to punch through the old wood like it wasn't there at all. They were going to smash through the unstable dynamite like a train wreck. The energy of their impact was going to act like a better blasting cap than anything any mining company had ever possessed. That was what those bullets were designed to do. Some committee had asked for a bullet capable of shooting through the sides of ammunition trucks, and that's what had been delivered. So Reacher wasn't shooting. 3 sentries. He might have risked it. He figured he could get off 3 aimed shots in maybe 3 seconds, too fast for any reaction. But 6 was too many. They were too spaced out. Too much physical movement was required between rounds. The later targets would have time to react. Not much time. Certainly not enough to be accurate. That was the problem. Reversing the geometry would be no help either. He could work himself right around to the south. It would take him maybe 20 minutes to skirt around in the trees and come back at them from the opposite direction. But then what? He would be looking at his targets uphill. The courthouse would be right behind them. He could hit each of them in the head, no problem at all. But he couldn't ask the bullets just to stop there in midair. He couldn't prevent those high-energy copper jackets bursting on out of the back of those skulls and heading on their uphill trajectories straight toward the courthouse's second-story walls. He shook his head and lowered his rifle. McGrath saw Borkin conferring with somebody on the edge of the clearing. It was the guy who had led the ambush squad, the guy who had taken his gun and his bullets and punched him in the face. The two of them were glancing at their watches and glancing up at the sky. They were nodding. Borkin slapped the guy on the shoulder and turned away, ducked into the trees and disappeared back toward the town. The ambush leader started in toward McGrath. He was smiling. He was unslinging his rifle. "Showtime," he called. He stepped near and reversed the rifle in his hands as he did so, smashed the butt into McGrath's stomach. McGrath went down on the shale. One guard jammed the muzzle of his rifle into McGrath's throat. The other jammed his into McGrath's stomach, right where the blow had landed.
"Lie still, asshole," the unit leader said. "I'll be back in a minute."
McGrath could not move his head because of the rifle in his throat, but he followed the guy with his eyes. He was going into the next-to-last hut in line. Not the armory, which stood on its own, some kind of an equipment store. He came out with a mallet and ropes and 4 metal objects. Dull green. Army issue. As he got nearer, McGrath recognized what they were. They were tent pegs, maybe 18 inches long, designed for some kind of big mess tent. The guy dropped his load on the shale. The metal pegs clinked on the stones. The guy nodded to the soldier with the gun in McGrath's belly, who straightened up and stepped away. The unit leader took his place. used his own weapon to keep McGrath pinned down. The soldier got busy. He seemed to know what he was supposed to do. He used the mallet to drive the first peg into the ground. The ground was stony, and the guy had to work hard. He was swinging the mallet in a big arc and using a lot of force. He drove the peg down until it was two-thirds buried. Then he paced off maybe 8 feet and started driving the second. McGrath followed him with his eyes. When the second peg was in, the guy paced another 8 feet at a right angle and hammered the third peg in. The fourth peg completed an exact square, 8 feet on a side. McGrath had a pretty good idea what that square was for.
"We normally do this in the woods," the unit leader said. "We normally do it vertically, with trees."
Then the guy pointed upward at the sky.
"But we need to let them see," he said. "They can't see properly in the woods. This time of year, too many leaves in the way, right?"
The guard who had driven the tent pegs into the ground was panting from the exertion. He changed places with his leader again, jammed his rifle into McGrath's gut, and leaned on it, recovering. McGrath gasped and squirmed under the pressure. The leader squatted down and sorted through the ropes, untangled one, and caught McGrath by the ankle, looped the rope around and tied it off. Hard. He used the rope to drag McGrath by the leg into the approximate center of the square. Then he tied the loose end to the fourth peg, tied it tight, and tested it. The second length of rope went around McGrath's other ankle. It was tied off to the third peg. McGrath's legs were forced apart at a right angle. His hands were still cuffed behind his back, crushed against the rocky ground. The leader used the sole of his boot to roll McGrath's upper body sideways, ducked down and unlocked the cuff, caught a wrist and looped a rope around, tied it tight and hauled the wrist up to the second peg. He pulled on it until McGrath's arm was stretched tight in a perfect straight line with the opposite leg. Then he tied it tight to the peg and reached down for the other wrist. The soldiers jammed their muzzles in tighter. McGrath stared up at the vapor trails and gasped in pain as his arm was stretched tight and he was tied into a perfect cross. The two soldiers jerked their rifles away and stepped back. They stood with their leader, gazing down. McGrath lifted his head and looked wildly around, pulled on the ropes, and then realized he was only pulling the knots tighter. The three men stepped farther back and glanced up at the sky. McGrath realized they were making sure the cameras got an uninterrupted view. The cameras were getting an uninterrupted view. 7 miles in the sky, the pilots were flying circles, one in a tight radius of a few miles, the other outside him on a wider path. Their cameras were trained downward, under the relentless control of their computers. The inside plane was focusing tight on the clearing where McGrath was spread-eagled. The outer camera was zoomed wider, taking in the whole of the area from the courthouse in the south to the abandoned mines in the north. Their real-time video signals were bouncing down more or less vertically to the dish vehicle parked behind the mobile command post. The dish was focusing the data stream and feeding it through the thick, armored cable into the observation truck. Then the decoding computers were feeding the large color monitors. Their phosphor screens were displaying the appalling truth. General Johnson and his aide and Webster were motionless in front of them. Motionless, silent, staring. Video recorders were whirring away, dispassionately recording every second's activity taking place 6 miles to the north. The whole vehicle was humming with faint electronic energy, but it was as silent as a tomb.
"Can you zoom in?" Webster asked quietly.
"On McGrath?" The general's aide twisted a black rubber knob, stared at the screen. He zoomed in until the individual pixels in the picture began to clump together and distort. Then he backed off a fraction.
"Close as we can get," he said.
It was close enough. McGrath's spread-eagled figure just about filled the screens. The unit leader could be seen from directly above, stepping over the lengths of rope as he circled. He had a knife in his hand, a black handle, a shiny blade, maybe 10 inches long. It looked like a big kitchen knife, the sort of thing a gourmet cook might buy, useful for slicing a tough cut of steak into strips, the sort of tool that would get set out on the kitchen counter by someone making a stew or a stroganoff. They saw the guy lay the knife flat on McGrath's chest. Then he used both hands to fold back the flaps on McGrath's jacket. He loosened McGrath's tie and pulled it sideways, almost up under his ear. Then he grasped the shirt front and tore it open. The cotton pulled apart under the knife, leaving the knife where it was, now next to the skin. The guy pulled the tails out of the waistband and tucked the shirt right back to the sides, carefully, well out of the way, like he was a surgeon faced with a difficult emergency procedure. They saw the guy pick up the knife again. He was squatted down to McGrath's right, leaning over slightly, holding the knife. He was holding it point down, close to McGrath's belly. The electronic pink of McGrath's skin was reflected in the faces of the watchers inside the observation vehicle. They saw the guy raise the knife an inch. They saw his index finger slide along the back of the blade, like he was adjusting his grip for extra precision. They saw the blade move down. The pale sun glinted on the steel. Then their view was disrupted. A silent puff of pink mist obscured the picture. When it cleared, the knife was still in the guy's hand, but the guy had no head. His whole head was a shattered pink wound, and he was toppling slowly sideways.